Good morning. This is Connor Thomas for KPCW filling in for Roger on this Friday, July 24th, Pioneer Day edition of the local news hour. It's 63 degrees around the Wasatch back right now with acceptable to moderate air quality. It looks like air quality may be unhealthy for some sensitive groups along the Wasatch Front right now, but marginally better up here in the higher valleys. Traffic appears to be crystal clear at the moment, save those usual commuter-based backups at some of our highway interchanges, with more on the weather forecast in our area. Here's ABC's Cedric Haynes.
Happy Pioneer Day, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Friday, July the 24th. And I'll tell you what, it's going to be a busy holiday weekend, of course, for many folks. And as you're going to be making your way out, just know we are expecting the return of some of this dangerous heat to build back into the region. If you're in Park City today for your Pioneer Day, look for plenty of sunshine. Those temperatures climbing to around 90 degrees this afternoon. We will have a chance of an isolated thunderstorm. It's going to be a very low-end chance. We're talking 10% chance or less. Otherwise, as we look at forecast for the Heber Valley, look for those high temperatures to climb into the upper 90s as they go throughout the afternoon with mostly sunny skies and just that slim chance of a pop-up shower and storm expected across the area. As we make our way into the rest of your holiday weekend, the temperatures will continue to warm up a little bit, so expect lower 90s expected in Park City for your Saturday. Again, just a slim chance of a pop-up storm, but mainly dry conditions expected. We'll be in the 90 to 93 degree range on your Sunday with mostly sunny skies and that slim chance of a pop-up storm. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley, you're going to be warming up to about 98 to 100 degrees for both your Saturday and Sunday afternoons with mostly sunny skies. And again, that 10% chance or less of a pop-up shower and storm. Now, as we head into next week, we're going to start to slowly see some changes here as that high-pressure ridge slowly pushes back towards the east. It may allow for a little bit more monsoon moisture to start sneaking in, but that'll be more closer towards the middle of next week. To kick off the week, we're looking at high temperatures in the low 90s in Park City for your Monday and Tuesday with partly cloudy skies. We'll be seeing those temperatures again in the mid to upper 90s in the Heber Valley with partly cloudy skies. Once we get that chance of isolated storms to return Wednesday and Thursday, that may dip our temperatures back down into the upper 80s in Park City with temperatures dipping back down into the low to mid 90s, of course, in the Heber Valley. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. Have a great Pioneer Day and Pioneer Day weekend. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up later on the program, we'll be checking in with Park City-based professional mountain biker Haley Batten about the upcoming World Cup race being held at Soldier Hollow in September. And then Marvin Rust and Michael Moulton will discuss the history of Pioneer Day in Wasatch County. And finally, Rich Wyman has details on Sunday's Dogapalooza, the second annual, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Ian Wyman Legacy Dog Park. Getting into some local news now, a Pioneer Cemetery in eastern Summit County suffered damage during this week's heavy monsoonal rains on Wednesday. The ground was still wet yesterday morning as Rockport resident Alan Sitaway was walking toward the northwest corner of the Wanship Cemetery. The National Weather Service had the area under a flash flood warning the day before, since the annual monsoon is bringing more rain than usual to Utah. The cemetery across from Wanship Dam on the west side of State Route 32 saw significant damage. After checking on his ancestors, Sitaway was headed to the grave of John Frederick, otherwise known as Dutch John from the Kingdom of Prussia.
So when he was buried in the late 1800s, he's up on the hill, which was considered like a pauper's grave because he had no family. So you can see he's not down here with the rest of the headstones from the same era.
The Camas Valley History Group calls Dutch John a strange man and mysterious healer who lived in a cave above the pioneer town of Rockport, now flooded by Rockport Reservoir. Sitaway says he would craft homeopathic remedies and tend to the townsfolk below. Now it's his family's tradition to tend to John's grave.
We'll have to come and fix this.
Rivulet's Branch and multiply down the hill from Dutch John's marker. Rainwater had dug trenches through family plots and pushed dirt into the parking lot yesterday. Alex Wetmore, who lives next door, had watched several people come and go all morning to check on loved ones' plots. There were no exposed caskets, but the weather appeared to have dislodged headstones and other memorials.
Yeah, this is unfortunately something that is not necessarily new. We've seen this kind of damage before from snowmelt in the winter specifically. I remember in 2023, I think it was.
A nearby headstone bears the Faith in Every Footstep badge, meaning its owner was among the Latter-day Saints who trekked from to Utah from Nauvoo, Illinois. Wanship resident Jacqueline Ball's ancestors are also buried in the cemetery, and she rallied neighbors on social media, drafting a letter to the Summit County Council asking them to, quote, consider installing or improving a drainage system, erosion control measures, or other infrastructure. Wanship Cemetery Maintenance District's policy leaves each burial site's management and landscaping to families. It has added rock to shore up the otherwise barren dirt. Board member Vern Williams says the cemetery doesn't have water shares. Otherwise, it could add grass or other landscaping. Once the ground dries, he says the district will regrade the slope with a skid steer. The district is staffed entirely by volunteers and collects roughly $20,000 in taxes and donations. Except for the Hoytsville Cemetery, Wanships has the smallest government budget in Summit County. In other news, former Hideout Administrator Jan McCosh says she was terminated in June by the town's mayor in retaliation for pointing out alleged financial mismanagement. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the mayor denies the allegations.
Former Hideout Town Administrator Jan McCosh claims she was fired by Mayor Ralph Severini after raising concerns about the town's finances.
My termination was retaliatory because I pointed out on several instances to council members, financial staff, our budget resident consultant, legal counsel, and others that there was gross financial mismanagement of taxpayer resources happening.
Severini told KPCW he, quote, respectfully but unequivocally disagrees with McCosh's allegations. He says the decision was financially motivated. At a meeting July 9th, he said it's redundant for a town Hideout size to have an administrator.
Based upon what other towns do in our class, there's 140 towns below 10,000. Almost literally none of them have town administrators.
An attorney with decades of financial management experience, McCosh had run the Wasatch County town since 2019. She says she was told June 11th her position had been eliminated due to a reorganization. The town website now lists Severini as its administrator. During public comment at a council meeting July 9th, McCosh alleged her firing was pretextual. That means she believes the real reason for the move didn't match the stated reason.
The reorganization was never discussed prior to the meeting that ensued after I was terminated. I was never given an opportunity to be heard until now.
She says she was let go because she questioned a proposed contract with Larry H. Miller Real Estate and the Military Installation Development Authority. Larry H. Miller is developing Silver Meadows, a mixed-use project in Richardson Flat that would create a Hideout town center. MIDA has a tax increment agreement in several Hideout neighborhoods.
There was a 2x2 with LHM MIDA to move forward with MIDA funding that would have resulted in a $7 million deficit spend to the taxpayers over a 10-year period. I met with LHM MIDA in a meeting earlier in the year, and in that meeting told them we needed to do financial modeling to find what was in the best interest of all of us. After that meeting, I was cut out from the future discussions with MIDA and LHM, despite the fact that I'm the administrator of the Silver Meadows annexation area.
Severini told KPCW no decisions have been made about economic development incentives for the Silver Meadows project, but that any proposal would be considered through the public process. McCosh further alleges Mustang Development, whose principal was the first Hideout mayor, had a hand in the decision.
My termination was likely because the mayor was asked to terminate me in collusion with the developer.
She says Mustang's attorney requested years' worth of her emails in December 2025. Severini told KPCW Mustang had no involvement in the reorganization. Mustang Development's attorney declined to comment on McCosh's allegations. MIDA spokesperson Kristen Kenny-Williams said Thursday the authority has always had a good relationship with Hideout and with McCosh. Larry H. Miller Real Estate did not immediately respond to KPCW's request for comment. The town council voted unanimously July 9th to affirm the mayor's decision to eliminate the administrator role. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In the studio now with us, we have Park City-based professional mountain biker Haley Batten. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So, you know, how based in PC are you these days? Have you been doing a lot of riding and training this year recently?
Yeah. I moved back to Utah last year, and I've been so happy to be back. I love the mountains here, and of course, for me, it's home just growing up here. I've been traveling a lot. I just got back home from a three-month trip. Just traveling. We started the season in South Korea, and then I've been in Europe for a couple of months. So I'm really enjoying being home. The trails have been great. I get a good training block in now. And I'm kind of just loving it every day. It's been great.
All right. Well, we're excited to speak to you today because you will be competing on home turf in September. The UCI is doing a World Cup race at Soldier Hollow. We got to speak with Soldier Hollow about the course because they've redesigned it for this event this year. Have you seen it yet?
Yeah. I walked the course a couple times in the winter or fall, I guess, before the snow came. And just discussed some ideas and the changes they would make. Warner Brothers came out and they're obviously planning all the camera positions. So it was, kind of in the works in the winter. But now, since I've been home, I've ridden the course a couple times, just making sure everything's kind of ready, World Cup level ready, you know. But it's looking good. And you can tell that the whole, everybody involved, all the organization is just excited for the race. And so I can feel the energy building for sure.
So you got to see the TV people also plan out or help give their input to the course designers about what the good angles might be?
Yeah, a little bit. That's a big part of it. Such a spectator friendly event. And so, making sure it can be seen on live coverage and really showcase our sport, both like the physical aspect of like the attacks and the fast-paced racing, but also all the technical features. You know, if they build something really cool, you want to make sure like everybody worldwide can see it. So that's a large part of the race, and Warner Brothers has definitely taken our sport to the next level by planning all that out.
Well, it's nice when you have laps and it's not like road riding where
exactly.
It goes right by. It's September 19th, that weekend. That's the date of the race. Soldier Hollow says the course is more technical with additional rock gardens, drops, jumps, etc. Could you describe what people will see if they show up?
Yeah, so originally a lot of races there, like U.S. races, it's more just like, I guess, the natural trail. And now we've moved the course up a little bit higher where there's some really cool, like, large rock features. We call them, like, rock slabs. And that I really like because it's a really natural section. Sometimes on the World Cups, there's a lot of man-made rock gardens, and there will be some of those. But I think Utah, the riding here is so special and unique. And, I mean, that's why we're famous for mountain biking, both here in Park City, Soldier Hollow, but also Moab, you know, St. George. Utah is a destination for cycling. And so I think that section really highlights, like, the natural terrain that we have. And then like I said, it's supposed to be a very spectator friendly race, so the course will kind of come back on itself a couple times so that people can see the course from multiple sections. If you get a VIP ticket, you can see almost 360 degree of the whole course from the top of their building there. And they're building some jumps, they're building up the drop, you know, making everything, I'm like, make it 10 times bigger, you know. It just, the level that everybody's racing at the World Cup now is just so high. So I think we're in a really good place where the course has improved a lot. And I think over the years to come, we can just keep making it better.
Yeah, they're saying the course designers are going away from A lines and B lines and trying to have more creative potential.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of what you're describing with some of these rock slabs?
Yeah, for one of the ones that I'm suggesting, I think there might need to be a beeline. Like, I'm hoping it's pretty technical and challenging and that riders get there and they're like, whoa, I need to like spend some time here and check out my line. But yeah, I think the goal is really to have multi-line sections where athletes can get a little bit creative and they can look at a section and decide, you know, how they're going to build their own way through the terrain. So we have a couple of those, but yeah, I mean, I think for us right now, it's just a good starting place, and I think we'll continue to build, and I'm just really excited about the opportunity.
How else is the sport changing these days, mountain biking in general?
Yeah, I'd say our sport, I mean, obviously the bikes are getting so good, so the technical features are getting bigger and bigger. The level's getting really high, so the depth of athletes that can ride at a really high speed, the races are super dynamic, interesting, kind of unpredictable, both in the women's discipline, but also the men's. So it's just, yeah, I mean, I could say, like, for myself in the elite women's racing, it's like 20 athletes that you think could win a race. And I think we'll see that on this course for sure. the speeds of courses are faster. People are riding faster. It's more tactical, so you have to think about your positioning and timing of attacks and that kind of thing within the race. But yeah, I think our course will also be really interesting because we're also at altitude. Like, we're in the mountains. There's a lot of climbing. It's one of the most climbing courses I'd say we have on the circuit for the World Series. And so I think, yeah, a lot of people are going to have to think about that and prepare in advance just because, yeah, it's one of the highest ones on the circuit too.
Is it getting fast enough to where you have to think about aerodynamics that much? Because I know people will sometimes... There's always discourse online about putting drop bars on mountain bikes and things like that. Is that something you think about for these races?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say for sure in the short track race, which is our... So we'll have two races at the World's Cup, one on Saturday and one on Sunday. The Saturday race, it's what we call short track. It's just a 20-minute race, really short loop, right there in the venue. And those are more similar to like a crit race on the road where the pack is quite large, the group rides together, and then you kind of have to think about aero aerodynamics. Everybody's wearing their aero helmets, aero socks, skin suits, taking every bit they can get, you know, every 1% for the race. And that race is really important because it determines the start position for the Sunday XCO. And we no longer have start laps in the XCO. It's all like the race starts and you go right into the regular course. So that makes the short track and performing there even more important, and incentivizes athletes to like give their best go in that race. And so that, I'd say, is like a really great spectator-friendly race. It's super interesting, really exciting, and it's just 20 minutes long, so it's a great race to watch, and it usually happens in the evening, which is quite fun.
Oh, that's good to know, because I was going to ask if you're going to do short track or cross country.
Yeah, both. Everyone. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Could you explain how the mountain bike season works as a whole? Because, you know, with skiing, there's a crystal globe at the end for overall, or is it just kind of race by race?
Yeah, I'd say there's like three really big events that athletes focus on in World's Cup mountain bike, or just in mountain bike racing and cross country mountain bike racing. And that's the World's Cup overall, which is similar to skiing, where we have a large number of World's Cup races throughout the season. We started this year in South Korea in May, and then we'll finish in Lake Placid in October. So it's a long season, and all of those races determine your points both in the short track and the cross country. You can win overall, and the points in the short track also contribute to the cross country. So there's two overall titles. Then we also have the World Championships event, which is like a jersey that you get to wear for the whole season, and that you're a world champion. And then we also have the Olympic Games. So I'd say those are three titles that athletes really, you know, focus their seasons on or try to peak their fitness for those events.
In prep for the interview, I noticed that you did win the Belgian waffle ride in Arizona a few months ago.
Yeah.
That is gravel though.
Yeah.
So how has that factored into your season? Are you getting more into that discipline? Are you going to switch over?
Yeah. I think for me, like, I just love racing my bike, and I think you can learn a lot from racing different disciplines. Obviously in the U.S., there's been, just a huge, huge growth in just cycling in general, with this marathon racing and gravel racing that's just booming here with the Lifetime Grand Prix, and also all these smaller events like the Belgium Waffle Ride Series. So yeah, I was training in Tucson. I saw there was a big race that weekend. And so I just like went up and did it for training, and they're really hard. And I think that every time you can step outside the box a little bit and challenge yourself, you know, against the clock or with competitors, it really, I think it just... you just learn how to suffer in new ways. And so for me, I just love the endurance events as well. I wouldn't say I would switch over for sure, at least for the next few years to LA 2028 Olympics. I'll be prioritizing cross-country mountain bike racing. But yeah, there's nothing wrong, I think, for me with dipping my toes into different disciplines. And I think a lot of athletes, just across the U.S., it's an exciting discipline right now, gravel.
Great. Well, again, September 9th, or 19th, sorry, and the 20th, that's the date for the Soldier Hollow World Cup race. We will see you there. Anything else that you want the listeners to know about the race?
Gosh, no, I'd love to see you there. I mean, it's a big deal for me. Just, this is the world that I love, the highest level of my sport, but also I get to bring that to the community that made me fall in love with this sport. So for me, it's like my two worlds coming together, which is honestly a dream come true, and I never thought it would happen in my career. So yeah, I'm really excited, and I hope to see everyone there.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wasatch County's second high school will be opened to the public for the first time on July 29th. KPCW's Christine Weller reports Deer Creek High School has been under construction for over 3 years.
After more than 3 years of construction, Wasatch County School District's newest high school is ready to welcome the community. Locals can walk the halls of Deer Creek High School for the first time after a ribbon-cutting ceremony July 29th at 5 p.m. Principal Justin Kelly said the building's design is modeled after the nearby Heber Valley Railroad, which was the largest sheep shipping yard in the country during the 1920s and 30s.
We wanted to kind of pay homage to some of the things that helped Heber get on the map. So when you come inside, it's going to have a feel of a train station.
Exposed rafters, large windows, and an old-style clock add to the ambiance. Other parts of the building pay tribute to the school's mascot, the Riverhawks. The logo is featured throughout the school. Kelly hopes Deer Creek will have a live mascot on site. There's an osprey nesting pool near the school.
We've had a couple of males coming and looking at it, and maybe when the construction kind of slows down a little bit, it'll get a little quieter, and hopefully we can see and get a osprey here, a river hawk.
Kelly said the common area at the entrance of the school is now fully furnished. It features couches and other seating areas to encourage students to stay on campus and socialize. Locals can also tour Deer Creek's athletic facilities, which are housed in an adjacent building. The structure includes a main and auxiliary gym, dance studio, weight room, running track, concessions stands, and a press room overlooking the football field. Kelly said Deer Creek's first students will get to name the building this fall. They'll also help create a fight song.
It's going to be fun for kids to look back in 10 or 15, 20 years when they can start bringing their kids and saying, I helped do this. I was a part of this.
Locals who can't make it to the grand opening July 29th can still tour the school July 30th. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Here to talk about the holiday and some of the celebrations and commemorations underway, we have Marvin Rust from the Wasatch Community Foundation in studio with Michael Moulton from the Wasatch Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
All right. So before we were going on air, Marvin, we were talking about something you've been involved in this year, which is the Chief Tabby statue and commemoration there in the Heber Valley, celebrating some of the indigenous history of the area. Could you explain some of that?
Absolutely. So the original pioneers really of the Heber Valley are the indigenous people, and I think we need to give them proper recognition and appreciate their history and the importance of the valley to them as well. The Wasatch Community Foundation is putting in a statue in the Heber Cemetery that gives proper recognition to Chief Tabby, who was an amazing chief who brought peace to the valley, was very instrumental in working with those settlers that came into the valley and had a mutual appreciation and respect one for another.
Yeah, where can folks go see the statue and learn more about, his history?
So the statue is not in yet. It'll be probably in September. It'll be in a roundabout right there near the new columbarium in the Heber Cemetery. And we will have a plaque that talks a little more about Chief Tabby.
Yeah. So which nation was he a part of? Did he lead?
My understanding that it was the Timpanogos Nation. Some have said that he was Ute. Those of the Timpanogos Nation say he was not, that he was a distinct nation tribe.
Yeah. And that was who the pioneers first encountered when they entered the area. Michael, maybe you could explain how settlement occurred in the Heber Valley.
The original settlement, of the Heber Valley occurred in about 1859, 1858, when a large group of immigrants to the United States from England, particularly, came into the Salt Lake Valley, and a lot of them in those handcart companies that are so famous, including my family. And they first went into Salt Lake, and then they moved up to into the Provo area, and they then heard about this Upper Provo Valley, they called it at the time. It had first been discovered a little bit earlier when timbermen came over the Brighton Guardsman Pass area and looked down into this valley and referred to it as Paradise Valley.
It looks nice. That's a good view of it.
That's a very good way to describe that, isn't it? Yeah. You can imagine the first time you laid eyes on it, you would think that. And so they finally, at that point in time, they Brigham Young commissioned a road up the canyon. Can you imagine building that with picks and shovels and horses?
Well, I was curious because it's off route for the Pioneer Trail. It's not like they had U.S. Highway 40 to go down into the valley. So they kind of did a loop around the Provo side.
And came up Provo Canyon with this road. And then that would have been in about 1858 or 1859 when the first settlers, there's a great story about the first ones trying to come up, and they ran into these major, major snow slides, which, you know, were always the bane of Provo Canyon in many ways. And so they disassembled their wagons entirely and carried them over the snow slide. Can you imagine the work and the horses? And then reassembled them so they could get back in. So that brought into the valley the original, the cattlemen, the sheepmen, and the timber industry was one of the major industries that they thought. They thought they could float the logs down the Provo River, which turned out not to work out very well, because if you've noticed the Provo River, it's not very deep.
Not this year.
Or any time to float logs down. But the cattle industry and the sheep industry and the farming industry drew all of these then settlers into the valley. The Moulton family arrived in about 1860. And they, in order to defend themselves from the perceived possibility of a battle with the Indians during what was called the Black Hawk Indian War, which really wasn't very prominent in Heber Valley. It was more difficult in other places. So they build a fort, built out of cottonwood that they cut by the river, and built little cabins all around. And so it became Fort Heber, and they also built a fort in Midway a little bit later on. There were about 44 families in that Heber fort, which we've done a lot of research on lately, and we just celebrate these people. They are amazing what they did.
You mentioned the forts they built. How much conflict was there between the indigenous populations that were already there and the settlers when they move in? How does that work?
Remember that story about Joseph Stacy being told to feed them instead of fight them?
Yes.
Tell the story.
So Brigham Young apparently told Joseph Stacy Murdoch, the bishop, don't battle these people. You feed them, you help them. So he apparently often was able to take, some cattle to them, and they appreciated that very much. And that was, I think, his friendship with Chief Tabby on that. So we always love that story. And most of these immigrants, settlers, were from England. The Swiss, you know, were also prominent at that point. But the English settlers were English and Scandinavian settlers. So the English heritage, the Scottish heritage, so the Scottish stonemasons that eventually came and built the magnificent building like the stake tabernacle and the what we refer to as the Norse school. The stonework is beautiful in it, and that was Scottish masons or stonecutters. But what they did was amazing. They built the roads. They built the canals, the miles of canals, you know, and the infrastructure which we have.
Well, what was that early road from Heber to Provo like? And how is it different from 189 today?
It was, first of all, one lane.
Yeah.
And totally dirt and rocks. And it would have been tough through those rocky cliff areas, you know, along the river. Then a little bit later on, of course, in the late 1890s, the railroad came. And they built their track on the other side, which is still, you know, basically there now as a walking trail on it from Vivian Park and down. But I had one person one time, a new person coming into the valley, said, don't tell me about your Mormon pioneers. I don't want to hear about it. And I bit my tongue off practically before I said, if it wouldn't have been for them, we would not have any of this. You know, what they did for us in this community is amazing.
You mentioned some of the different places the immigrants came from. My understanding is the Swiss were kind of concentrated on the west side of the valley, and that's where you get, you know, the area named Interlaken, for example. Is mm-hmm. that right, or is that mm-hmm. more of a Scandinavian descent?
No, that's the Swiss. Interlaken is a Swiss village or area.
How much later did they come from the British, compared to the British and Scandinavian immigrants?
I think they came first, and most of these were converts to the LDS Church, taught by Heber C. Kimball, one of the early church leaders.
Namesake of the town, of course.
And thus, they ask if they could name the town after him. It is, we understand, he probably never did visit Heber Valley. But we are really grateful that we have that story about him, and we're actually trying to build more on that legacy which he left. He supposedly said, this might be myth, but he supposedly said something like, you can name your valley after me as long as you never do anything dishonor my legacy. Name. And so we're working pretty hard to make sure that still happens.
Yeah. You know, what kind of things can people do today in the Heber Valley? What will you be doing to celebrate the holiday?
Well, I'm going back to our little area to have a pancake breakfast. So that's our big celebration of the day.
Yep. And Charleston seems like the epicenter of a lot of it.
Charleston for Pioneer Day, that's correct.
Yeah.
They'll have a big event there.
Yeah, that's neat. And we have our family personally participates in a family reunion today. I think there are quite a few people that do that. We've often, with our grandkids being in band and a few things, have gone to the 24th parade in Salt Lake, which is a really big deal.
It is.
That we like to participate in when we can, although I don't particularly care for the traffic part of it anymore. But it is it's just a hometown family kind of day for us on the 24th celebration.
Yeah, I think usually the train at the southeast area of the county is running. Is that the same today?
Oh, it will be. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think they're very busy.
Any historical stories you've got in your sleeve regarding the train and the Heber Creeper?
Go ahead.
Well, I have no history with the train, but I do know that we are, and Michael is very much the forefront of trying to improve the depot that's there and bring back a little more of that history through putting in a major renovation, if you will, of the original depot.
Mm-hmm. On it. I love the stories that I've heard, and probably a lot of them are myth things, kind of build upon over the years, but why it was called the Heber Creeper.
Yeah.
They just simply apparently would stop and wait for the chickens to lay the eggs to be gathered up to bring them on into town. A good friend, name will remain unmentioned here, who talks about the story that he heard that a woman got on the train in Heber who was, you could go to Heber, you could go to Provo, you could go to Salt Lake, and you could make the round trip without, and be back by 8 o'clock at night. They had a number of trips on that train. So the train became the gathering place. But anyway, the woman got on the train, and somewhere down around one of the stops down, which is now underwater with the Deer Creek Reservoir, she rang the cord and said, you've got to stop, I'm going to have a baby. And they said, well, why did you get on the train if you're going to have a baby? And she says, because when I got on the train, I wasn't going to have a baby.
So this is, it goes down as humanity's slowest train ever. All right, well, that should be fun for folks that want to take a joyride on that today.
It is.
It is, you know, it's America's 250th this year, if my math was correct, 179 years since the pioneers entered Salt Lake Valley. Yeah. You know, what are you thinking about as we kind of celebrate these big milestones, big picture wise?
We really have some dreams, you know, and visions of that. Mark Nelson, the director of the Heber Valley Railroad, which is called now, is putting together a plan and an idea for what is called Heber Valley Heritage Days. Hopefully, maybe starting that next year. And one of the main parts is as a replacement for cowboy poetry, which had been such a major, you know, thing for a number of years. And so the idea of Heber Valley Heritage Days would celebrate, you know, the heritage of the English, of the Scandinavians, of the Swiss, of the indigenous people, of the Hispanic people. He really has some neat ideas for this, and in our foundations and other things, we'll totally buy into that.
Kind of like a fair, but very history focused.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else that you all would want to mention regarding Pioneer Day or history before we sign off here?
Well, I would just like to mention that I appreciate the courage, the fortitude, the hard work. These are things that we need to better understand, and our children understand that they need these values in their life to understand it takes work and it takes determination to make good things happen.
We want to make the stories of these early people live. That's kind of become our mantra, make their stories live, because there is so much to learn from them. And we really do not have to discover a whole lot of things if they've already discovered it.
All right,
make their stories live.
Thank you again, Michael Moulton from the Wasatch Heritage Foundation and Marvin Rust from the Community Foundation there in Wasatch County. Thanks for revisiting Pioneer Day with us once again.
Thank you.
Turning now to local news, Recycle Utah's Summer of Sustainability is offering films, dinners, and events to help the community go green. KPCW's Ula Britt Libre has more.
The Park City-based organization works to divert waste from the local landfill while educating residents on ways to help. Recycle Utah is reaching out to the Wasatch Back with green-focused events this summer. Executive Director Andy Hecht says the center will bring back its impromptu barbecue July 28th.
Right after work, right about 5 o'clock, we pull out our big green egg and we host a little gathering of friends and family for Recycle Utah. Bring hamburgers, bring some beverages, come and have fun.
The nonprofit's annual 100-mile meal is August 22nd at Red Pine Lodge. Featuring food sourced within 100 miles of Park City, the dinner is capped at 200 guests from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m.
Vail does an amazing job. Their chefs love to be on that dinner because they get to be creative. They think outside of the box with the ingredients that are brought to them, and they make an amazing meal.
After everyone eats, the center will share plans for its new facility during the Recycle Utah Rendezvous until 10 p.m. The move will expand the nonprofit's educational space and recycling capacity.
We are excited to share with our community the direction Recycle Utah is going, and this is finally the chance we get to open up and show everyone.
The group hopes to break ground in March 2027. Supporters can attend the entire evening for $300 or join the rendezvous later for $100. Complete details and tickets are available at kpcw.org. Recycle Utah is a financial supporter of KPCW. Ula Britt Libre, KPCW News.
And a man serving life in prison for a double murder now seeks new evidence to challenge his 2001 conviction. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports he's asking a Wasatch County judge to intervene.
25 years ago, John R. Pinder was sentenced to two life sentences for kidnapping and killing Rex Tanner and June Flood. The 68-year-old Duchesne County Ostrich Rancher has since filed several unsuccessful appeals. On Tuesday, Pinder's lawyer asked a Wasatch County judge to allow new discovery in the case. Attorney Anne Marie Taliaferro could not be reached for comment Wednesday, but But court documents show Pinder's latest petition stems in part from a death row case that's getting a fresh look. The Salt Lake Tribune reports new DNA evidence may show Douglas Stewart Carter is innocent of a decades-old Provo murder. Pinder argues his case, too, has more evidence worth considering. He claims no physical evidence ties him to the crimes. Key evidence may have been falsified, not all relevant evidence was disclosed at trial, and several witnesses provided unreliable testimony. Pinder alleges that law enforcement may have tampered with 911 call records to show the murders happened on a date when he didn't have an alibi. He also says law enforcement paid off or otherwise interfered with witnesses who testified in his Wasatch County trial. He's asking a 4th District judge to order the Duchesne County Sheriff, Duchesne County Attorney, and Utah Attorney General to produce a long list of additional evidence in his case. Pinder was convicted of shooting two of his employees in October 1998, then blowing up their bodies. Before the murders, the Deseret News reports he was known for keeping a lion as a pet. The Utah Supreme Court upheld Pinder's conviction in 2015. His first parole hearing is scheduled for November 2028. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In studio with us now is Rich Wyman with details on the second annual Dogapalooza.
That's right. That's why I'm here.
So 2 years in a row, is this going to become a tradition now?
I'm hoping it does. I'm hoping it grows because, you know, Lollapalooza is this big festival in Chicago. It's like hundreds of thousands of people, and that dog park's pretty big. So I'm thinking, you know, over the course of years, we could get bigger and bigger acts and make it like a major music festival in the dog park.
Yeah. So tell us about the dog park. It was renamed last year sort of in memory of your son, and that's
yes.
when the Dogapalooza event began.
Right.
Why did it begin? Why did you organize this?
Well, the mayor and the city council unanimously voted to change the name of the dog park to the Ian Wyman Legacy Dog Park in honor of my son Ian, who, when he was 10 years old, went to the city council back in 2005 when there were no dog parks and asked them why there wasn't one. And he was crucial to the dog park becoming a reality. In 2009, I have a picture on my wall of him and then Mayor Dana Williams with giant scissors cutting the ribbons, and him in his Boy Scout uniform. By then he was 14. And sadly, when he passed away in 2004, Mayor Nan called me and asked me if there was anything she could do, and I said, can we change the name of the dog park? And that started the wheels turning to get the name changed, which we did, and they voted, like I said, unanimously to change the name of the dog park. And for the dedication, because they put up a beautiful sign, they spent money on landscaping and a new fence, and they really improved it with some AstroTurf. I wanted to make it a real event, so last year I hired the Brazuca Brazilian Band to come and play. I played some songs, and we had a Best Dressed Pet Contest, and it was just a great celebration of Ian. And the city, I think, was all the city council members were there, and past mayors, present mayors, future mayors. It was a real celebration. We had a few hundred people, and it was just such a great day. And I was like, okay, let's do it again. So here we are a year later, doing a little bigger. We've got a little more music. Kate Chanson's going to start the day at 11 o'clock. She's a local singer-songwriter, so she's going to start the day off. And then former Mayor Dana Williams and I are going to play some songs. And then we're going to do the best dressed dog contest. It's a free event, so please, everybody come and bring your dogs and dress them up. So it's going to be a little bigger this year, a little more music, and after we do the best dressed dog contest, the Brazuca Band again is going to come and play their Brazilian incredible music for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, a few hundred people is a lot of people. That's it sounds like a lot of joy. And for the details again, it's Sunday, 11 a.m. to 2
yeah.
at the dog park in the Round Valley area. You've really been pushing the dress up the dog stuff. And I'm curious, who won last year and what was the costume, if you can remember?
I do very well because it's my best friend. I've known Mark Barson since I was 4 years old. We went to nursery school together in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and he lives in Los Angeles now, and he came out with his wife and their two dogs, and he had this incredible costume. It was a pumpkin patch farmer. So the dog had this pumpkin thing around him, and attached to his rear was a farmer. It was very strange, to say the least, and he won first prize.
That's good. You can reuse your stuff or honestly innovate maybe off of whatever you do for Halloween on Maine with your dog.
Sure.
I'm curious about the Brazuca Band. Who are they? And can you tell their story a little bit?
Sure. The leader of the group is Diego, and he is from Brazil. I think most, if not all, the members of the band are from Brazil. And I heard them playing somewhere. I can't remember where it was. And it was just such joyful, joyful music. And also, I went to Burning Man a few years ago, and I spent 2 days at the Brazilian camp at Burning Man and just fell in love with everybody there. They are just such wonderful people. My wife and I are planning a trip down there in January. Anyway, so these guys are all from Brazil. Great band, great musicians, fun music, and great guys. I love these guys. Such positivity and the music, you just can't help but dance to it and smile and have a good time.
And will you be performing as well?
I'm sitting in with them as well, yeah. So cool. I'm going to, Dana Williams and I are going to do a little duet set, and then Brazuca Band's going to come in on and start, and then I'm going to whenever the mood suits me, I'm going to jump up with them and hop on the keyboards.
You might have just mentioned it, but who are the food truck and coffee vendors that people can expect to see and enjoy while they're out there?
I've got the vendors here. So the food truck is the Falafel Tree Food Truck with Chef Abby. And I met these guys I did a gig July 5th, and they were the food truck, and it blew my mind how good their food is. So they're going to have a big food truck there. Inti Specialty Coffee, is a guy named Julio. He's at the farmer's market every Wednesday, so I've known him for a few years. Sweetest, nicest guy as well. These are all wonderful people. But he's from Peru, and he brings this Peruvian coffee that is just amazing. So we've got great coffee, we've got great food, and then we've got the Barking Cat with Justin Cutler. And we've got Nuzzles and Company, of course, Leslie Barkas and Brody. And they're going to have some dogs there if people are looking to get a dog or they just want to pet a dog. And we've got the Puppy Potty Bus, Lori Davino. And that's a new addition this year. We didn't have them last year, but apparently that's a bus that picks dogs up and brings them to the park, and they have their own little bus, and it's very cute. I've seen some videos.
Will they be participating in Nuzzles as well in the dress up the dog contest?
Yes, they've actually offered. They're going to contribute some prizes. So the prizes in the best dressed dog contest are generously being donated by Barking Cat and by Puppy Potty Bus.
Who judges the contest?
My son's girlfriend.
Okay.
So it's not me. It's not any.
I was going to say, if your best friend won, that I would have had to ask you a few questions about that.
I excused myself from the judging of the contest.
Okay. Anything else that you want people to know about the event this Sunday?
Let me see. Well, I want to thank Mountain Town Music because they donated the sound system. And I want to thank everybody who's at City Hall, Chris Finney and Archie. They've all been, again, like they have been from day one, just superstars. I would ask people to bring chairs, umbrellas, coolers, anything you want, so that you can relax. You might need a little shade because it might be sunny out there. And just like you're coming to a concert, bring a chair and a cooler and a little umbrella. I don't know if you want to bring a blanket because there's dogs do pee on the ground there, so...
What are the beverage rules for this particular park?
What
are the beverage rules?
No, there are no rules.
Okay, okay.
It's a fun... You'll see a lot of smiles on Sunday, I can tell you that.
All right. We've been speaking with Rich Wyman about the upcoming second annual Dogapalooza event, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Ian Wyman Legacy Dog Park there in Round Valley. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Connor. It's been good talking to you.
And one last bit of local news here. Park City resident Jen Drummond stood on top of North America's highest peak last month, setting her second world record. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has this.
Jen Drummond completed her Project Climb Higher on June 1st of 2023 when she became the first woman to climb the second highest mountain on each continent. On June 18th of this year, she added another milestone, becoming the first woman to climb both the tallest and second tallest mountains on every continent after reaching the summit of Denali. After completing the 7 second summits, Drummond realized she only needed 3 more peaks to earn the second record. 2 of them could be climbed with some of her children.
So I said, okay, let's do this. We went to Mont Blanc. Jacob and Joe and Jonathan summited that with me. I flew to Russia, grabbed one real quick there, Elbrus, and then came home. And Jacob and I headed up to Denali and had a great, great experience.
Drummond is pragmatic about the accomplishment, saying the records matter less than the opportunity they've given her to inspire others.
It gave me a platform to help other people stop postponing life and live your some days list, which we all have.
Looking back, she says the most technical climb was Dick Tau in Russia. The most mentally demanding mountain was her final one, Denali. Drummond doesn't have another major climbing challenge planned for now. Instead, she says she'll begin checking off the family's someday adventures with her children. The first is taking all 7 of her children, including her 13-year-old twins, to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, Africa's highest peak. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.